And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. This is Martin Willis, your host. We have Alejandro Rojas coming up with the news in just a bit. Tonight, we have two guests. Our one is the one and only Eric Von Daniken, and that's a pre-recorded show because, in theory, he is sleeping right now in Switzerland, as it is the middle of the night. Our two, we have Barbara Harris. She's going to be live, and we're going to be talking about the contactees of yesteryear. Should be an interesting topic. There's some really fringy stuff involved in that. We'll see how that goes. Both of these fine people can be seen at Contact in the Desert, Joshua Tree out in California, and that's May 29th through the 31st, coming right up. Well, I want to thank everyone for their support, and I'd like to thank people like Mr. Davis, Mr. Allen, Mr. Sanders, Miss Colleen, Miss Nelson, Mr. Marsh, Mr. Sanderson, Mr. Sikora, Mr. Jacobson, and many more. I'll mention some more next week. And if you want to hear the second part of the show, just go to our podcast, podcastufo.com, and right on the sidebar, you will see how to do that. That's Get Joy Ride. You can use a private link in iTunes and all kinds of, or any type of play media. I should say player media. It's a slam dunk. It's pretty easy. So for only a dollar or more per month, you can help us out, help us pay expenses. And some of those expenses are some nice blogs. We have one coming right up with Michael Lauk, a great writer. He's going to be providing us with some interesting blogs. So check out our website again, podcastufo.com. And with no further ado, we are having Alejandro Rojas. He's back from vacation, rested and ready to go. How are you, Alejandro?
I am doing well. I've got a bit of a cold, super busy, had a lot to catch up on since I've been back. Luckily, I didn't catch the cold until like the last day of the trip, actually during the traveling day. So didn't ruin my trip at all, which was amazing. And hopefully people follow me on Facebook and Twitter. You know, you can find my stuff at openminds.tv. It's AstroATR on Twitter and just Alejandro on Facebook, because I post, you know, pictures and stuff like that. If people are interested, some people might be like, oh, what do I care? But
yeah, well, you know, I had I was at an antique fair, and a fan came over to actually see me, a fan of the show.
Cool.
And he said he's really dying to meet you someday.
Oh, that'd be great. I love meeting listeners. In fact, I'll be going to Contact in the Desert.
Oh, that's right.
Just,
yeah.
Not this weekend. Maybe we could talk more about that next week, but in a couple weeks, so people can meet me there. Some other stuff like MUFON coming up, the Travis Walton Conference, stuff like that.
Right. So, you know, before we move along, it is time for me to pick out the $10 or more T-shirt thing. So the only thing is, if I pick out the same person I've already sent one to, they will not. I'll have to pick someone else. So if anyone supports the show for $10 or more per month, it's our once-a-month drawing. And just, Alejandro, I'm going to ask you right now, this is unrehearsed. Pick a number 1 through 8.
7.
He's European. It's going to cost me some postage. Anders Jacobson. You get a T-shirt. It's probably going to cost me $900 to mail it to him over there, but that's okay. So, all right. So let's move on to the new... Wait a minute. There's something I wanted to say to you. While you were sailing the seas and everything, all this alien slide thing went down. I bet you were kind of like jonesing just a little bit for it. I know that we're not going to cover it because we've already talked about it.
What do you mean we're not going to cover it? That's what I've been doing the last 2 days is pouring over all the Roswell slide stuff. And actually, I wrote my story up yesterday. I finally, oh my gosh, it took me forever going through so much stuff to get caught up. But it's all in my story. I even listened to your podcast, you know, because you had the perfect people. You had Kurt Collins, Kevin Randall, Philip Mantle, all of whom are in my story. I even reference a comment from Philip in your podcast because those are the best people to have. So really, you did a great job getting those guys, and really your listeners are pretty caught up. But if you want anything else, in fact, how to recreate some of the deblurring, you can go to my story and see that. But you know what was funny? Luckily, I have been, you know, Philip and others have been getting me information. So even while I was on the ship, I'm checking my phone for stuff. And I downloaded the deblurring program. And then we set sail, and I'm out of contact for many days. So luckily, in order to rest, I had to let it all go. And I did. But every chance I got here and there, I would play with the deblurring program to see if I could recreate the placard thing and also to get familiar with the program. I wasn't able to recreate the placard thing, but then I found out, you know, it took the guy who was able to finally crack it hours and hours and hours. But at least I knew the program then, so I knew what he was talking about, and I knew how to manipulate it and recreate the deblurring myself. So, yeah, I was really curious, but I knew the thing had been done. So it was, you know, nice to hear that Don had apologized and kind of given in, and because I had been hearing from some of these guys about. You know, disappointed in the take I was taking. But, you know, my thing was, it looks like a mummy. You guys need to tell us. I don't understand why you think it looks like an alien. So Adam Dew, right before I left, said, hey, if you have some questions, I'll answer those. So sure enough, as soon as I got back, I had some questions, and I told him I'd be gone. And I haven't heard from him, surprisingly.
That is shocking. Now,
yeah, I know.
I don't want to talk too long in this, but we'll...
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. But... I will say, if you heard the show, then you heard me say that I didn't think Jaime Mossain was going to actually come out and admit it. And because he has such strong followers, he could say whatever he wants, and they'll follow him, you know, all the way. And so far, that has held true. And
has held true, and it's unfortunate. And Robert Salas wrote interesting thing on UFO Chronicles where bringing up some concerns around that, and I think they're valid.
All right. Now I'm going to have to check that out. That sounds interesting.
But I do want to thank you, too, to mentioning that, you know, I had done the interview with Adam Dew because he hasn't spoken with many people, and not many people interviewed him. And I think it's important that they should have sought to do so because he's really kind of getting demonized. Everybody's starting to say, oh, it's his fault that all this happened. Maybe it'll turn out that's the case. We're not getting much information. But thanks for mentioning that. And kudos to you to at least trying to get him on your show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't hear. You know, he was actually communicating back and forth with Peggy, who, you know, helps with the show, right up until the day before the you-know-what hit the fan.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went into stealth mode and is probably under a rock somewhere, or he should,
yeah.
Should be anyway. But anyway,
we'll see what happens.
Yeah, so that's kind of funny. We just talked about for 5 minutes of something we said we weren't going to talk about. But that's all right. So let's move on to this week in UFO news.
Okay, I'll try to be kind of quick, but this is kind of cool. Now, you and I had talked about this before when in the New York Daily News, this guy who was a pilot for Obama during the 2008 campaign had written an article, because he writes for New York Daily News occasionally, about his own UFO sighting and saying kind of, you know, people are afraid to talk about UFOs, but you know what? I've seen one and I'm laying it all on the line and here's my story. Well, Fox News interviewed him the other day, and this is really kind of cool. It was on Fox and Friends, a show I never watch, on a channel I never watch, Fox News. But, mm-hmm. the interviewer was Clayton Morris, and this is kind of interesting because they were treating him very nice. I thought maybe, uh-oh, they're going to make fun of him. But they let this Andy Danziger talk. It was kind of interesting because the Clayton Morris asked, well, why haven't you talked about this before? And he said, well, there's no policy not to speak about UFOs at my airline or any other airlines I've worked at. But it is kind of an unwritten rule because we don't want our careers to be affected and people are kind of ridiculed for believing in this thing. But he did say, as he wrote in the New York Daily News, that I have talked to other pilots about UFOs, and he says most pilots believe in UFOs, which is pretty cool. So he talked a little bit about his sighting, and you can read that at length, you know, on our site or on his article. Essentially, they saw this kind of disc-shaped object when they were flying from Kansas City to Iowa, and then it turned into this large red orb object, and it was really incredible to them. But this is kind of cool. So Morris, the host, must be into UFOs also because he says that when he interviews pilots, he often asks them about UFOs and if they've seen UFOs. And many of them say that they have seen UFOs, but they would never talk about it. They keep it quiet. And then Morris again asked Danziger, you know, why do you think that is? And Danziger again said, probably because they don't want to be brandished just being crazy. And he noted that the government seems to discount UFO sightings, and the media can be jerky about the whole thing too. So why say anything? So I thought it was a really incredible interview that one, you know, Danziger would stick by all this stuff and kind of share why pilots don't talk about it. But two, that Clayton Morris, the host, seemed to really be into UFOs himself. Quite shocking.
Wow, that's something. Now, has Danziger retired or is he still active?
That's a great question, and I don't know that for sure offhand. I can't think of it. So I'm not sure about that.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it seems like he could be a little more comfortable coming out of the closet about it, you know, if he has indeed, you know, retired. But if he's still active, I'd be actually surprised. He was an Air Force One pilot, right? So they're top notch.
Yeah, he's a top notch. You know, we've got pictures of him with Obama and flying the Obama plane and everything. So, yeah, he's got to be a pretty serious pilot. And it's a really cool story.
Now, I wonder if this has trickled back to Obama himself or if it's just like he's just too overwhelmed with everything he's dealing with to even take notice of something like this.
It's a great question. My sense, even with all this latest stuff, you know, with Obama and everything, speaking on Jimmy Kimmel, my sense is just from watching this, and I watch Obama a lot. I listen to him, and I'm a news hand. I listen to NPR all the time and everything. I think Obama really likes to make jokes about the topic. He's always joking about UFOs and everything. So I don't think he has an inclination to really look into it seriously. And there's no reason he should. I mean, politically, it's a hot potato. Why do it? He's busy with other stuff. It's kind of like Paul Hellyer, who's a defense minister of Canada. I've asked him about, you know, when he was defense minister, did he ever look into UFOs? And he said once in a while something would come across his desk and he would throw it away. He wouldn't even give it a look because he's like, I'm too busy with serious stuff to worry about paranormal phenomena. So I think that's probably where Obama is on all of this. So hopefully one day, maybe once he's retired, which isn't going to be too long from now, he'll actually look at this stuff, or maybe someone will ask him about you know, Danziger and his sighting. But I don't think he gives it too much thought at this point. That's what I think.
Going back to Paul Hellyer, now, I'm kind of surprised that he takes the stand now when he, you know, when early on he obviously didn't have all that much interest, or he was just plain too busy.
Yeah.
What would you guess?
Well, you know, in these days, I'm brutally honest about how I feel about this kind of stuff. I've asked him in details when he first came out about this stuff. We've had him speak at the Congress. I've had lunch with him and stuff. I haven't in a while. But he says, yeah, he wasn't interested in it before. What got him interested is he read the Day After Roswell book, which came out in the 90s. And he thought that was interesting. He says he asked a friend in who's a general in the U.S. If it was true, and the general said that, yeah, he believed it was true. And that's when he started getting into this. Then he started talking with UFO researchers, and I know in particular a couple that he really liked and started listening to. And now it's kind of like the Boyd Bushman thing or even the Edgar Mitchell thing. They regurgitate all of this real far-fetched, you know, stuff that they're hearing from these UFO researchers or UFO enthusiasts. And that's it's real similar to Boyd Bushman. So in that, unfortunately, you know, when he says a lot of what he's saying is his personal opinion. But the only thing he says he knows for a fact is that he asked his friend who is a general who told him, yeah, that Day After Roswell stuff, something in there is probably true.
Wow. Well, I know we got to kind of make the other stories a little bit shorter, so because we're running on a deadline tonight. So, what is the next story?
Yeah, I was going to talk about. I'll go over this really quickly. Just a couple sightings, MUFON sightings that Roger Marsh has posted on our site, and one of them is in Indiana. On May 16th, there were quite a few people who saw these red orbs that were floating across the sky. Now, they did say they didn't make any sound. They were moving in one direction. The witness said that a jet seemed to be flying towards the red orb, and then it disappeared. Soon after, another red orb disappeared, moving in the same trajectory, or appeared, and it moved in the same trajectory and then disappeared as well. It kind of sounds like Chinese lanterns on this one, but who knows? But this was a sighting in Indiana on May 16th. But a bit more interesting is a sighting in Delaware, and this was on May 2nd. And there's this family watching the sunset, and they say that they saw this large rectangular object blocking out the sun right at the horizon. They even drove around, got in there. They're so mystified by it, got in their car, drove around, trying to get a better angle at what this thing was, but they weren't able to get any more. They tried to take a picture, but it didn't really turn out. And finally, when the sun set, they couldn't see this thing anymore. But that's kind of a weird one. It's a really strange sighting. I haven't heard anything quite like this report.
Really? Well, and so for the listener, you can go to our show notes, and all these links will jump right over to these stories. And Alejandro, thanks so much. And hey, by the way, you're going to be around next week?
I will be.
All right. So we'll be talking to you next week then.
All right. Talk to you next week, buddy.
All right. So everyone hang in there, and we'll be right back after this quick music clip with Eric von Däniken. So I am on the line to Switzerland with Eric von Däniken. How are you?
Hello. I'm really sitting in the sun here. It's great.
Are you outside in the sun?
Yes, I'm outside. It's a wonderful day here. It's like Americans would call an Indian summer, all through its springtime.
Yeah, we've had some strange weather. It must have something to do with ancient aliens.
God.
So anyway, I just we talked a little bit beforehand, and I'm a big fan of yours, and I think the work you have done, you know, has really changed basically society. I mean, people are looking at your ideas in all different ways. There's been a lot of TV shows, and I want to publicly thank you for the work you've done.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to hear this. In the meantime, I'm 80 years old. or young, but my brain functions fantastically.
Wow. Wow. And you're coming up pretty soon here at Contact in the Desert. Are you pretty excited about that?
I'm happy about it. This is Contact in the Desert. It's in Joshua Tree. I was there last year, and it was absolutely great. There were thousands of people sitting all around and later listening to my speeches, having questions and answers. I was very happy. That's why I'm happy, too, to come back this year.
Great, great. Now, I want to ask you, I'm sure you've probably been asked this a million times, but how did you conceive of this whole idea in the very beginning? And before you even get into that, what sparked your interest in looking at this type of thing that you got into?
You see, I was educated in Switzerland as a strict Catholic. And I was for 6 years in a boarding school led by Jesuits. And I must say, I was a deep believer in God. By the way, I am still a believer in God. I am still one of these persons who pray every day. But my God, when I was young, had to have some minimum qualities. For example, God would never need a vehicle in which to move around from point A to point B. God is everywhere. Or God is out of time. He would not use to make experiments, and then he has to wait what the result is. He should know it in advance. Or, of course, God makes no mistakes, etc. Now, in my boarding school, we had to make translations of parts of the Bible from Greek to Latin and from Latin to German. And there I read that my God, which I adore, the God of the Ancient Testament, makes mistakes. And he uses vehicles in which to move around from one point to the other. So I simply had doubts in my own education. And I wanted to know if other communities in antiquity have similar stories as we have them among the Jewish and Christian community. And that was the starting point. I was nearly 16 years old.
Oh, wow. And where did you start, like, exploring? And I know you've been everywhere looking into this. When did you start actually writing and exploring?
You see, from my family, I came from the hotel business. So after my high school, I first went into the hotel business. I was in hotel schools. I was a waiter. I was a barkeeper. I was all kind of in the gastronomy. When I wrote Chariots of the Gods, I was the managing director of a first-class hotel in Switzerland. But during all this time in my hotel business, I was traveling and traveling as much as I could. I don't know in how many countries and how many ruins I visited. And, of course, how many books of religion and mythologies I read. But there were hundreds and hundreds. And finally, I came to an idea. Why should the hotel manager not write a book? And I did it. And that was Chariots of the Gods.
And had you had any literary education?
Well, only in high school. You see, I was only 6 years in high school, but that was a very, very brilliant high school in Switzerland and a very expensive high school too. So there we learned to write and to speak and to read and to research.
I see. Now, I want to just do a quote that I had Dr. Seth Shostak from SETI on my show. And we sort of debated UFOs way back, I don't know, a year and a half ago. And I mentioned about on the cave walls to him. And, you know, I said, well, how would you explain, you know, back in ancient times? I said, they may have been here forever. And how would you explain on the cave walls the drawings? And then he said, well, my three-year-old used to draw, you know, things just like that.
You know, that of course, he's right, but that's not everything. Oh, you see, we have cave paintings all around the world, and the so-called gods are always represented with halos around their head or with rays coming out of their head. Now, in Stone Age time, these people had no contact from one continent to another. So why have they all come to a similar idea worldwide, be it in Peru, in Australia, in the Sahara Desert, wherever? The gods were always represented with halos around their heads, with helmets and things like that. But that's only half of the answer. Of course I know that our first religions, Stone Age people, were natural religions. You see, our Stone Age ancestors, they realized that the lightning is coming from heaven. They hear the thundering later, and they could not understand what the significance was. Or maybe they saw the moon on the sky, and then it disappeared the next few days. So they could not understand all these things. So the first religions definitely were natural religions. But then the beings from the sky descended. And there is a big difference, because these beings from the skies, they were teaching. They gave information. So they taught our forefathers, for example, in astronomy. They taught them how the calendar works, that the earth is surrounding the sun in 365 days, etc. And that's the difference between a natural religion and the extraterrestrials. Natural religion does not teach in a scientific way, but the others were speaking.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that have always puzzled me and wondered what, you know, the scientific answers were to, or I should say theories are there are so many similar things that spring up in cultures, not just like cave paintings, but a lot of things worldwide that just do not make any sense unless there was some type of travel at some ancient time. For instance, in Mexico, there's a Chinese influence that goes back to, you know, over 2,000 years. And supposedly, there was not supposed to be any travel at
that
time.
Of course not. And yep. You see, I always use an example. We all live in a Christian society, and we have a great and wonderful Christian culture. For example, we have wonderful Christian churches, cathedrals, and we have them worldwide. You find Christian cathedrals in South America. You find them in Europe. You find them all over. But none of the artists, none of the painters was there when Jesus Christ was alive 2,000 years ago. They all did their work because of tradition. They learned it. It happened something 2,000 years ago. The same thing happened with extraterrestrials. These extraterrestrials were here. They behaved themselves as today's ethnologists would do. They studied a few tribes. They learned a few language. They gave a few advices. And one day they disappeared with the promise, in a far future, we will return again. And now this message went throughout the world, like the Christian message. And now the artists in Central America, in Mexico, in South America, they start to chisel, to make sculptures, to make paintings, all because of traditions. They were never eyewitness when the extraterrestrials were here, comparable to Christianity. The painters and artists were not eyewitness in the time of the life of Jesus Christ.
Right, right. Now, I want to go back to you. And any time that anyone comes up with such a revolutionary idea and that someone hasn't come up with before, faces a lot of turmoil. You know, you go back in time, Galileo, and I'm saying, you know, he was like saying the, for instance, you know, the earth goes around the sun, that type of thing. So when you came out with this and there was the publicity started, the book started, you know, just the sales on the book just started soaring and all that. What type of turmoil, if any, did you go through?
Well, in the beginning, I was crushed down more or less by the whole scientific community. First of all, I was not a scientist when I wrote Chariots of the Gods. I was a simply managing director of a first-class hotel. So the critic said, how can a managing director of a hotel write such a book? What are his qualities, etc.? And then, of course, I was attacked for a lot of reasonable grounds. For example, an astronomer would say, well, visitors from outer space, that would mean they had to reach somehow the light years, the distances. But this is not possible. Nobody can reach the speed of light. So Erich von Däniken must be wrong. or in Chariots of the Gods, I compared these teachers from heaven with humans. They had the form of humans. Now the critics say this is rubbish. I mean, evolution on another solar system would go in complete different way than in our solar system. So if extraterrestrials would exist, they might maybe look like flying elephants or whatever, but never like humans, etc., etc. So the critics had good reasons to critique myself. In the meantime, we know that it will be possible to reach the speed, not the speed of light, but to reach between the stars, to make space travel between the stars. We know for what reason extraterrestrials might well look similar to us. There's a good reason for it, etc. So the situation has changed. I mean, Chariots of the Gods is nearly 45 years old. So really, the situation has changed, and I would rather say has changed a little in my favor. We see it differently now.
I believe so. And I've heard that argument as well. Like, I think I heard a scientist say something like, well, they, you know, what stops them from having, you know, 14 eyes or something like that. But, you know, the binocular view is, you know, the best. It's all, if it is, you know, based on evolution, everything about us, the opposing thumbs, you name it, it's all evolution and just... So I think it's pretty close-minded to think that it's not possible that something would look like us. I mean, apes evolved as well.
Well, you see, there was a Swedish Nobel Prize winner that's 70 years ago. His name was Svante Arrhenius. And he, in his time already, came up with a theory which is known in the scientific community as panspermia. Mm-hmm. Panspermia says... At some place in our galaxy, in our Milky Way, there was the first form of life. Now you could start and say, halt, stop. How did the first form of life started? We have no answer. You see, in religion, in philosophy too, we say in the beginning was God, and God was the Word. And in astronomy or astrophysics, we say in the beginning there was the Big Bang. But in religion, we ask, okay, what started God? Where does God come from? In astronomy, we say, okay, and what started the Big Bang? Mm. So the theory of panspermia says, it started somewhere. The first intelligent form of life had a certain interest to spread out their own form of life. And now they do it by just infecting a section of the Milky Way with their own form of life, which is possible. Spread out their own form of life. By the way, that does not contradict evolution. We are still products of evolution. But in a way, we are offsprings of another solar system. And this, again, is handed down in every big religion, even in our Christian religion, that says, and God created humans according to their own image.
You know, I said this before in a couple of podcasts, and it's a little redundant for my regular listeners, but when I was in high school, I came up with this. I wrote for English an essay, basically, that I had an answer for the reason that there were different races throughout the world and that we were seeded here from different planets. You know, it was just kind of sort of like a fictional writing, but it was actually received the best of anything I ever did.
I'm happy to hear this.
Yeah. And but I do remember your book everywhere, seeing your book everywhere, and like I had friends reading it, and you know, it really, just the title alone, I mean, I don't know how you chose that title, but it's such an intriguing title in English. And did you have a hard time getting the book published? And once
Yes. You see, at that time, I finished the manuscript in 1966. Mm. And at that time, we did not have our today's copy technology. So when I wanted to make a photocopy of a page, I had to photocopy each page on its own. It was not just a 200-page story. I copied my manuscript 20 times, and I sent 20 copies of it to 20 different publishers in the German world. And all the 20 publishers sent the manuscript back, and they said, no, it's not good, it's too speculative, it's not written in a professional way, or it is not part of our program. So I was absolutely crashed down before the book was on the market. But as I said before, I was a managing director of a hotel. And in this hotel, every winter, we had a brilliant guest. He was the chief editor of a scientific newspaper in Germany. And he said one evening to me, Eric, why don't you write the book? And I said, listen, I have a manuscript, but I cannot find a publisher. And then he said, well, I know a publisher. I will phone him tomorrow. And I remember, as it would be yesterday, he said to someone on the phone, which I didn't know, listen, Erwin, I'm standing here in Switzerland before a young man, and this man has written a complete crazy book. But the human, the man, is not crazy. You should maybe listen to him. And that's how it started. So Chariots of the Gods came on the market in 1968.
Well, I bet all those publishers were kicking themselves in the butt for that.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. You know, I'm what I do for real work is I'm in the fine arts and antiques, and I have dealt a lot of time at auction with pre-Columbian pieces, pottery, and figures. And I got to tell you, you know, when I was cataloging these pieces over the many years, they're the strangest. Some of the figures are the strangest looking things. I mean, so alien like. And I just pulled up your website, and I saw you have some type of figure down right by your email address, which is just reminding me of that.
Okay.
And so have you – this is just a little offshoot of this, but are you also a collector of things that you find that are intriguing, that are ancient?
No, I don't collect material. I don't collect any original. I never stole some original from another country. Of course, I have copies of many of the artifacts. And I must say, I have the biggest archive concerning pictures. I have about 200,000 pictures. And in the meantime, they are all on the computer. Wow. The original still exists in form of slides, but 200,000. And by the way, in Joshua Tree, you know, Contact in the Desert, I have at least 3 speeches and workshops, and I will, well, show you pictures which you have never seen before from all over the world, pictures which should not exist in archaeology. For example, you are talking about Colombia. In South America is a country called Ecuador. In Ecuador is a place, a city called Cuenca. And there, some 25 years ago, was an old priest living. His name is Father Crespi. We know each other very good. And Father Crespi had an incredible collection of objects, of arts, all kind, which the Indians make to him because he helped them in every way, also against the government sometimes. So I photographed at least 500 incredible objects. You see pyramids. And pyramids which have a writing on it. But this writing has not been deciphered by nobody. I published some of these books in a picture book. And from the archaeological side, there is no answer. We don't know what it is. So they say it must be falsificates. But they are not falsificates. They are real old, well, the pictures and the arguments and the motifs on it is thousands of years old and nobody understands it.
Well, amazing. Now, talking about the pyramids a little bit, you know, I mean, what do you think is more intriguing, the pyramids or the Sphinx? And another thing about that is these things are, you can't really, for my own, you can't really date stone. I mean, stone is...
No, you cannot directly date stones. As soon as they are broken off the rock, you cannot date them anymore. But you see, the pyramid, that's a long, long story. According to Egyptologists, the Great Pyramid was constructed by Cheops. Cheops was a pharaoh in the 4th dynasty, roughly 2500 BC. And generally, you can say, why should he not have made this building? Well, these were more or less stones. Stone Age people, not directly. They were in the Iron Age and so on. But the problem with the Great Pyramid is not the construction itself. It's the planning. In the meantime, because of electrical or electronical measurement, we have found inside the pyramid different new shafts and rooms. They are small, these shafts and rooms. Only robots can climb in there. By the way, I show some of these new shafts in my speech in Joshua 3. Now, as more shafts and room you have inside the pyramid and under the pyramid, as more complicated becomes the planning. The planning means engineering work. You have to plan everything before you start cutting rocks and moving rocks about. And the planning does not fit in Cheops' time. They don't have this engineering knowledge at that time. Now, again, we have ancient traditions. For example, there are Arabian chronists. Ibrahim Abdul al-Makrisi is one of them. And he wrote, the Great Pyramid was constructed before the Great Flood. And it was made by a pharaoh with the name of Saurit. And he says, Saurit is the same figure which the Hebrew community names Enoch. Now, Enoch, again, is one of my friends. He was taught by the guardians of the sky. He was up there. He learned their language. And finally, he disappeared with them. So, to me, it makes sense. Enoch was the seventh patriarch before the Great Flood. A brilliant figure. He was taught in scientific learning. By the way, I'm sorry, my mother language is German. I always have to translate a little. So, and he wrote 300 books. And before Enoch left our planet, he gave these 300 books to his son. His son was Methuselah, the one from the Bible. And he gave it them with the words, my son, keep these books for mankind after the Great Flood. So it was done before the Great Flood, as Arabian historians say.
Wow. Wow. On all your travels, I was looking through some of your pictures that you have on your website. And all your travels, what do you think is the most unique man-made structure that's ancient?
Well, for me, it's still the stone of Palenque. You see, Palenque is a place in Mexico. And Palenque today is a tourist place, an archaeological place. There is a pyramid which is called the Temple of Inscription. And in 1952, Professor Dr. Rutz discovered under the Temple of Inscription a secret tomb. The tomb was covered with a big stone, I mean big, 3.8 meters long, 2.2 meters large. That's quite the block. One block, one monolith. And on this stone block was an incredible chiseling. You see something like a frame. And in this frame is sitting a human being. He's bending forward almost like a motorizing cyclist. He uses his two hands to manipulate some controls. He's definitely sitting on a chair. And outside the frame, you see something like a linking flame. Now, this stone has a writing around it, and some of this writing can be translated. So we know for sure the figure which is represented in this stone is Pakal. Pakal was the second last ruler of the Maya city of Palenque. But in the beginning, in 1952, until about two years from now, all the archaeological explanations was Pakal is sitting in the open mouth of a mythological monster. He's falling into the earth. And out of his chest, you see something like the cross of life or the tree of life. But in the meantime, and this is just 1.5 years ago, the scientific translation has changed completely. There are two professors, American professors from the University of Texas. Their name is Stewart and Stewart, it's the father and the son. And they are the best translators, definitely, in Maya language. And now the new translation, they say, yes, it is Pakal, the second last rover, but he's not falling into the earth. He's traveling out from our earth, out in the universe. And every little thing on this famous stone block can be seen. It has to do something with the universe and with the cosmos. So that the situation has changed. You ask me for the best looking place. Look at this stone from Palenque, and you are really scatterers.
Yes, I just pulled that up. I pulled up the structure overall. Pretty amazing. You know, the thing that always puzzles me is how, with what they had to work with, the tools they had to work with, how could they create such incredible, works of art? It always puzzles me. A lot of times in our society, we always think that people were not as smart as we are today and all that. And I can argue that we're probably not anywhere near as smart as most of them were. Let me just think here. I will edit this, by the way, but so far there's no reason to edit. It's been going well. So I'm just trying to think of where to
accept your point of view. you see, okay. What puzzles me all the time is that some of the stone blocks and some of the chiselings, which are very, very old, have used more technology than the later stones. For example, in Egypt on the Nile is a place called Abydos. And in Abydos there is a temple from a pharaoh, which we know from the 13th century. Now, beneath this temple of the pharaoh, his name is Setos the First, there is another structure. And the structure is much gigantic and bigger than the temple of Seti the First, which means the oldest monuments are more precise concerning technology than the later temple. It should be differently, because in evolution, you learn with little things. You learn to move small stones, little stones, and then you learn how much to transport bigger stones, how to cut them, to chisel them, how to transport them, etc. So evolution in technology starts small, and then you become smarter and smarter and more intelligent. But in Abydos, this is one of the examples, what is all on the opposite. The most perfect technology is the oldest one, and we have no explanation for it.
Right, right. Speaking of technology, if you think about it, the way that we are always developing technology, as far as like penetrating radar and penetrating through different waves, objects, and I think that more and more of these ancient places will be found, you know, deeply buried. Because over time, you know, everything gets buried, and undiscovered and forgotten about. And just wanted to get your opinion on this. What do you think mainstream science would do if they discovered more along the lines of what your theory was, or even that the human race was a lot older than, you know, the 2 million years or whatever it is they're suggesting it is?
Well, in the beginning, we always have to be reasonable. And mainstream scientists will in the beginning be against it. But science is an open society. And normally, those scientists I know are brilliant men. You know, and they learn and they accept when you can prove a situation. So the situation will change because of our technology. Just let me give you two little examples. Everybody is talking about the changing of climate. Now, I don't doubt the changing of climate, but what do we do? Because now the ice, for example, on the Antarctic is melting. What do we do when suddenly out of the ice a building appears? We can do nothing against it. We know that this building must be thousands and thousands of years old, otherwise it would not be covered by the ice. And now the ice melts and the building comes out. So what can the scientific community do against it? Nothing. Mm-hmm. Or in South America, in Peru, we have this very well-known plain of Nazca. Nazca is a desert. And when you fly over it, you see gigantic figures in the desert. Then you see gigantic lines looking like airstrips, etc., etc. Now, we always looked at Nazca as something unique. Nazca only happens in Peru. But thanks to technology, thanks to satellites, thanks to satellite photographs, we know in the meantime that we have at least in 5 different places on our planet something similar to Nazca. We find it in Saudi Arabia, we find it in Jordania, we find it in Russia, etc., all by satellites. So suddenly we have to ask, hey, Nazca is not unique. Why have our forefathers, thousands of years ago, on different continents, made gigantic carvings in the ground, lines and pictures, which are so big that you can overlook them only from the air? Why have they done this on different countries? Now, Erich von Däniken comes and says, I'm sorry, we have old writings, we have literature on which these gods, the so-called gods, are described. They were flying around with flying machines called winged gods or vimanas in India or whatever. So take the old literature into consideration, and then you find an explanation for these signs. The humans made these signs, not the extraterrestrials, but of such overdimensional size that you can see them only from the air.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I like to bounce around a little bit in these discussions, and now I'm going to ask you, I know you've written a lot of books. We can talk about that as well. But since you wrote Chariots of the Gods, how did your life change? What just walk us through what happened.
Well, I was the managing director of a hotel, and I gave up the hotel. And I simply just was a writer and researcher. With the money I made, by the way, I have never become a rich man, still until today not. I still have an open tax bill. But I spend a lot of money in traveling with my colleagues. Sometimes I financed expeditions in Saudi Arabia or in Brazil and so. So I earned money and I spent money. So my life has changed. And of course, in Chariots of the Gods and in earlier books, I was a young man. And as a young man, you are enthusiastic. You are not self-critical enough. And you believe sometimes every rubbish which someone may tell you. So later, you learn, do not repeat any mistake. Every book has to be perfect and controllable. Every source has to be correct. So that's what you learn, what change in your life. In the meantime, as an 80-year-old man, I think that the scientific community accepts the way how my theories are presented.
Well, that's good to hear. That was going to be my next question, was to ask you if you had, like, any scientists that you're aware of. I was looking at your Legendary Times, and if you want to talk about that a little bit. This is something you publish, right? But you have, like, a membership, 10,000 members. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you see, long time ago, that was in 1971, I had speeches in the United States, and one evening an American lawyer came to me. His name was Gene Philip. He was an absolutely modest and sympathetic man, and he suggested to me we should create an Erich von Däniken Society, and I was against the name of Erich von Däniken Society. I was for a society. You know, I had something in mind like the National Geographic Society or whatever. So I said to him, all right, we make a society, but let's find another name. And he suggested the name of Ancient Astronaut Society. And this Ancient Astronaut Society gives out a magazine every 2 or 3 months, which is called Ancient Aliens. Now, this society has an American branch and a European branch. And in America, you know my friend Giorgio Tuscolos. Everyone knows Giorgio Tuscolos from the TV series Ancient Aliens. He's doing this, his job, wonderful. I'm doing this in Europe. Our magazine has, in the meantime, 45 pages, is in full color and comes out every 2 months. And there we always present the newest findings. Of course, the newest literature, and there we published where Erich von Däniken has speeches, where can you see him, etc. I'm happy that we have this international organization. Among the German organization, we have at least, I would say, 100 scientists from different faculties.
Really? Wow. Now, I think Giorgio has been a really good thing for publicity because everyone knows him by his hair. So he comes up everywhere in pictures all over the internet, and then people that have never watched Ancient Aliens, all of a sudden, like, oh, you know, they get interested just because of him.
And Giorgio even has an own TV series in the meantime. By the way, Giorgio grew up in Switzerland. Oh. I knew him when he was nearly 18 years old, young man. So we were together at that time already. Later, he went to the United States.
How about that? I never knew that. Now, let's talk about your other... Have you really written 55 books? I thought it was 20-something.
No, no, it's 37 books in the meantime. Ah. With the total edition of around 65 million copies, something like this. But as I said before, I have never become a rich man. I'm traveling all the time. Just in 3 days, I'm going to Greece. And then, as I said, in about 10 days or so, I will be in the United States in California.
Wow. And you travel all over the world constantly, don't you?
Yes. Oh, constantly, all over the world, not only for speeches. Sometimes I have a lot of speeches, but also for researchers. You see, whenever I read or I hear something of new discoveries in archaeology, and whenever I hear it has something to do with astronomy, or it's strange, or we cannot explain, of course, I take the next aircraft and I go there. And I look for a contact with the local archaeologists, and those who I know are absolutely brilliant and friendly personalities.
Uh-huh. Excuse me. Let's talk about that, the astrological lining up of the pyramids. I am going to edit this, Eric. I got to tell you, I'm working in the antique fair, and I'm totally exhausted. I'm trying to hold it together. What am I trying to say? The alignments of different structures, that's what I'm trying to say. So how would be a good way for me to pose that question?
Well, that's a complicated, really thing. Yeah. You see, everyone knows more or less about the Greek mythology. There is a god with the name of Zeus. He had a son of Apollo, etc. Now, in Greece, we have different old holy places. They were temples already in Stone Age. Later, these temples have become classical structures like Delphi, Epidaurus, Acropolis, etc. But what we know, all these old holy places are linked together in the same distance and always in the same angles. So you can just measure it very, very easy. The distance from Delphi to the Acropolis is the same as the Acropolis to Epidaurus, from Epidaurus the same distance, etc., etc. This goes on and on. Now Greece is a land with mountains and hills, and sometimes they are islands which are 200 kilometers away from the landscape. Now, and there again, you have the same distances. So someone must have measured the old Greece before Plato, before Pythagoras, before Euclid. It was all already there in Stone Age. Why? Why has somebody told to our forefathers, okay, you want to make a temple or a building in our honor? We accept this, but please make it just on this place which we tell you. And the others say, okay, only on this place. And I have a hunt why they have done this. They knew exactly that far away in the future, thousands of years after the visits of these extraterrestrials, mankind would develop technology. We would find the way of flying as we have our aircraft. Then we would measure our lands. We would realize that some of these old sightings and holy places are all linked together in the same geometrical measures. Soon as we understand this, and this is a fact which everyone can control, soon as we know this, we start to ask questions. We ask, hi, how is this possible? Was there maybe another civilization before our civilization? Or someone may come up with the idea, were there maybe extraterrestrials? Could this be an explanation? Now we are exactly in this situation. We have this measurement, and we have the question. Have we been visited from outer space? And we ask the next question, well, if so, what is the proof? They must have left something. Where do we found the answer? But without these Stone Age places, we would never come up with the question. So it was done on purpose. The future generation should start to ask questions. And that's exactly our situation today.
Mm-hmm. And, pardon me. Of all the research that you have done all through the years, which would you say is the most compelling evidence that we have been visited?
Well, the greatest mystery is still, and this only nowadays, the Great Pyramid. As I mentioned before, by electronic meanings, we have discovered shafts and rooms in and under the pyramid, which we did not know before. So this is a mystery. The other mention I mentioned is Palenque, this tombstone of Palenque. And the other one are the holy books. You see, some 170 years ago, in Ethiopia, in an old library, a British man found the book with the name, The Book of Enoch. This Book of Enoch was translated from the Ethiopian language into English, and later from English into German. But the translations, the first were 170 years ago. At that time, no one, no of the professors or the translators, knew anything about flying. There was no flying machines 170 years ago. No one knew something about space travel, spaceship. So the translations were always made in the sense of religion. For example, they translate, well, two angels descended from the sky to the earth. They took Enoch up into the sky, into the heaven. There he came together with the Almighty God. In the meantime, the new translation makes clear it was not two angels, it was two extraterrestrials. He was not taken into heaven, he was taken into space. He was not sitting before the great throne of the Almighty God, he was sitting before the chair of the commander of the spacecraft. So it's all a question of the spirit of time, how you translate these old texts. Now in India, we have a brilliant professor of Sanskrit. His name is Dr. Kanjilal. He now translated old Indian texts in this modern sense. And the result is absolutely baffling. The same thing happened with Sumerian cuneiforms. We have a German professor in Sumerology. His name is Burga. And he translated now Sumerian texts, cuneiforms, in this modern sense. And he told me, Eric, this is fascinating. In the past, we all translated it from a religion's and the psychological view. But it is not religion and psychology. It was reality. And the outcome is fantastic.
Over the years, with all your books, starting right from the very beginning, I'm sure that you were met with a lot of skeptics, you know, trying to explain everything in your book, in your books and in your writings and film and all that. How do you deal with that?
I love them. You see, this still goes on until today. Mm-hmm. Last week, I had a speech in a university in Switzerland, in a city called Fribourg. It was not a public speech. It was just a normal university speech, you know, in an auditorium with about 45 students and about six professors. And there, I, from my side, explained that in ancient India, some flying machines existed. And there were differences between different machines. Some of them could fly to the moon, others could overfly between the continents, and so on. After my short speech, a professor of Indology answered it. And he said to the students, well, we have to understand this completely different, as Mr. von Däniken says. We all know that rich people today, they have some cars, for example, a Mercedes or a Ferrari. They are proud of having one or two cars. Now, the cars are sometimes open. They go with high speed, and the air comes to their hairs, etc. And he says, in antiquity, we had the same thing. The rich families, they had some cars, chariots. They were driven by two or three or four horses, and they were standing on these chariots like we see it in the movie Ben-Hur. And also in ancient times, because of the speed of their chariots, the air was floating through their hairs, etc. So we have to understand these flying chariots in this way, in a natural way. Now, so you see, the skeptics are still trying to find a natural explanation explanation. Later again, in our very friendly debate, I said to the professor, it's wonderful, your point of view, but in the ancient Indian texts, you can see clear differences between cars which have wheels and others which have no wheels, between cars which touch the ground and others who do not touch the ground. And he said, well, I'm not familiar with these texts. In the meantime, I send it to them. So the situation will change. We live in another world. The spirit of time has changed.
Now, the show that we do here is on UFOs, basically, and this, of course, is, you know, all part of it, I believe. But what is your thoughts on today's sightings?
You mean these UFO sightings?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, personally, I never had a UFO sight. I don't know why. I love to see one. But on the other hand, I know of the new UFO books. You see, in the old UFO books, sometimes there is a lot of rubbish inside, and the people believe very quick. So, and in the meantime, we have some scientific books, at least in the German market. Some of them exist also in the United States. For example, the book of Leslie Kean or the book of John B. Alexander. And there you see the eyewitness, and they speak, and these eyewitnesses are scientists who were scientists in the past years. In the meantime, they are retired, or governor, like the governor of Arizona, Mr. Fife Symington, and now they tell what they saw some years ago and what they had, and they tell us that they did not tell us the truth some 10 or 15 years ago. So again, the situation changes. I myself have received just a few months ago a disc, a CD from a fighter pilot from Costa Rica. And there you see a UFO, and definitely there is no falsificate, because everything, you know, when you take the pictures from the cockpit of a fighter, an air fighter, then you see all the how you call it, inscription inside, the distance to the object, the exact time, the geographical position, etc. By the way, I show this UFO film also, again, in Joshua Tree, and I give it up to discussion. I showed this UFO to some scientists here in the German community, including to Chandra Vikramsim. He's the chief of astrophysics at the University of Cardiff. I gave it to him just a few weeks ago, and he told me at the phone, Eric, we cannot disprove this anymore, but we don't know what it is. Definitely there is an object appearing, flying over the earth in high speed, going into the water, coming out of the water, and we cannot explain it. This must be another dimension. But at least things are here. Some 20 years ago, we all denied it. We said nothing is here. In the meantime, we learn something is here.
Mm-hmm. So you just had your 80th birthday just last month. And
yeah.
Happy belated birthday, by the way. Are you doing any more writing at this time in your life?
Of course. It's never ending. Ah. I'm happy that the gods love me and my brain is functioning perfectly. You see, I had some 2.5 weeks. I had this 80th birthday, and there was a congress in my honor in Germany, and there were 3,000 persons. And I was very, very happy and very proud and graceful. Of course, and a lot of connections again, and wonderful connections with scientists. So the situation again has changed.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Eric, this is wrapping up the show. I want to thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you.
It's a pleasure for being with you. Thank you for your help, for your understanding, and I'm happy to come to California.
Wonderful.
Okay,
now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Okay, so that's it for the first part of the show. And hang in there for the music break. We'll be right back for the second part of the show and Barbara Harris talking about contactees.
Barbara?
It would help if I had my microphone on. I think I'm the one who told you to make sure.
Hi there.
Boy, you know, I do have to say some apologies about that just now, and also for the live listener. And, you know, I'm just going to keep things the way they are, and I'm just going to say that by accident, I had just ran the file that was unedited with Eric Von Daniken, so I apologize for that, but it's just like hearing a live show, except for the fact that I tell him two or three times that I'm going to be editing it. But that's the way it is. It's raw. It's all the way it was at the time, and that's how we do our live show anyway. So Barbara, I want to welcome you, and we need to know the scoop. What's your story? And I know we're going to be talking a little bit about, is it Great Rock? I always get that mixed up with Big Rock or Great Rock.
It's a giant rock.
Giant rock. Something big. But let's talk about all that and who you are and how you get interested. And I guess we have something in common, too. We're into historical societies and history a bit.
Oh, yes. That's my background. First of all, I'm from the East. I'm from Pennsylvania. And in the late 70s, I migrated out here to California, and I found my way to the Mojave Desert. And I would come out here to the Mojave Desert, and I started to enjoy the desert. And so I found this thing out in the desert, and it was this giant rock, and it was connected to this other thing called the Integratron. So you got to imagine this way back in the 80s, okay? So the early 80s, and I would be coming out here to this desert and this giant rock that would be standing out here. And this rock was 7 stories tall. It was 25,000 tons, and it covered an area of about 6,000 square feet. So, I got really intrigued by this back then in the 80s. And I started doing research on it. And as I started to find out more and more about it, man, this thing went way back. And it would go back to the early Native Americans of the time. And I found out all about that history. And then it connected to the early homesteaders of the time that moved into this area, the Mojave Desert. And then it got really interesting because then it connected to a man named George Van Tassel, and I think many of your listeners might know of George Van Tassel because he has a connection with the contactees, and George Van Tassel was known as the first space channeler, and that was in the 50s and the 60s. And where it got really interesting for me was this giant rock that sits out in the middle of this desert out of nowhere. As I did more and more research, I found out that in the 1950s, mainly in the late 1950s, there was a time that as many as 15,000 people would migrate out to this rock to listen to George Van Tassel and other contactees of the time come to listen to him speak and talk about their UFO experiences. And I come to find out that this was a very popular spot for UFO sightings. So, yeah, that's a little bit of what drew me out here into the desert. And in the year 2004, my husband and I uprooted ourselves from the coast where we were living in Southern California, and we actually moved out here and made this our home. And eventually I became president of the local historical society and did more research and have had well over 30 years of research now in about Giant Rock and the Integratron. And now I'm doing speaking engagements and still researching this giant rock and this rejuvenation machine called the Integratron.
Now, yeah. Now, have you heard of a lot of sightings in that area?
I heard of it, yes. And according to a lot of my research, this area in particular has a lot of documentation with sightings. And me in particular, I actually got photobombed in March by a UFO. This is no kidding. We were on our way up to Joshua Tree National Park, which is very close to this giant rock, and actually where the Contact in the Desert is going to be held this year. And we were out with some friends, and we were out taking photos and doing some things. And my friend was taking pictures, and she went home, and she sent me over her photos. And when I downloaded the photos, I emailed her back, and I went, ha-ha, nice trick, you know, photoshopping that UFO in the background. And she emails me back, and she goes, I didn't do anything. And eventually we pulled up the photo and looked it over, and there's this spaceship floating around in the background. And none of us even knew it was there. Didn't see it when we took the photo, and it's quite common. It happens quite a bit out here.
Now, did you ever have anyone else look at that photo closely, like anyone that does any type of research or anything?
Yes. Well, I can't say intensely, but we did put it up on Facebook, and I do have a few associates that are very involved in the UFO field, and of course we did have a lot of people examine it. They gave their perspective on it, what it was. We went over it with a fine-tooth comb, everything with regards to the shutter speeds, how fast it was going, all the details that would involve with that particular photo. We can't debunk it. We don't have anything we could actually say it is a UFO, because nobody seems to know what it is. And basically, when you work it out, somebody just says it looks more like a scout ship is what ultimately the final, synopsis of the whole photo.
I'd be glad to share that with a friend, Mark D'Antonio. He is the chief investigator for images and video for MUFON. I'd be glad to share that with him and see what he has to say about it, if you'd like.
Oh, yes.
And we can talk about that off air, of course.
Okay.
And let's talk about, is it the Integraton?
Yeah.
Is that that's a structure?
Yes.
That's built. Yeah. Okay.
That's connected very much to Giant Rock, because that was part of George Van Tassel's legacy, you might say. And how that came about was George Van Tassel, he lived at Giant Rock. He moved his family out there. And what happened to him is he was at Giant Rock, and as he was out there one night, he says that he had a spaceship land, and he had contact with people from Venus. And the story goes into detail in many of the Van Tassel writings. But basically what these people from Venus told him, and I like to summarize very quickly, and they told him that, you know, you people on Earth, you humans, you're coming along okay as a species. However, it seems by the time you finally get it, you die. So what these beings from Venus were going to do, they were going to give George, and what they did is they were giving him information about technology and to give him, you know, ways of how to extend and how to rejuvenate human cellular structure. Thus, that was the building of the Integratron. So in order for George to raise funds to build the Integratron, that's how he built, he would do these spaceship conventions out in the desert at Giant Rock, and he also started a foundation called the Council for Universal Wisdom. And he had a booklet called The Proceedings, and these little booklets would go out and people would make their donations. So he built started building the Integratron, and the Integratron has now been very popular. People can look it up. And it was a structure that was supposed to be able to rejuvenate the human cells. But it never got turned on because George Van Tassel died before it ever got turned on. But the actual structure itself is very fascinating, and it has a big history behind it. The big thing about the Integratron is that it works in conjunction with Giant Rock, because where it is built is very important, because it sits on a spot that converges on a ley line, the same as Giant Rock. Plus, in the center of the Integratron is where three aquifers, which, for those who don't know what the aquifers are, it's three underground rivers converge. So that creates a very strong energy field or a vortex. And also, what also makes the Integratron very special is the fact that it's built like a parabolic shape, and it's built in a sacred geometry. So its shape amplifies that energy. Plus, it was built with no metal. It was built in the way like shipbuilders would build. So you had an upstairs and a downstairs, and you had a positive and a negative charge. And what was intended was that it would spin on a bed of air, and as it would spin, it would create this positive charge, and people were intended to walk through the building, and as they walked through the building, this charge would then rejuvenate their cells. So it gets real more complicated than that, and they can always go to the Integratron, you know, website to find out more information and look it up, because it is very detailed. And Van Tassel, again, you know, he got a lot of this information from, you know, the people from Venus. So,
well, what do you think about that? And, you know, I mean, we know that life on Venus is impossible virtually. And, you know, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts? I don't really know, in the fact that the people from Venus. Now, when George describes these beings that he did meet, I kind of question it, because it seems that the people that he describes from Venus, they were always blonde hair and blue eyes. They were very tall, very gorgeous, and you know, you would think of them as beings of love, you know, voluptuous and that type of thing. As for saying that they were coming from Venus, who knows? You know, there might be underground, you know, places. There might be things living in Venus that I don't know about. So, again, like extraterrestrials or UFOs, I don't have the knowledge or the, you know, the foresight to know what's going on other planets, so I can't second guess it. I'm always leery of people or things that project, you know, their visions or their ideas. I guess, too, that people who can explain maybe a situation, they have to relate it to something that they can associate. So maybe George saw something, but the only way he could explain it was in terms or in ways of things that he can associate. Maybe he saw something, but all he can describe it as is blonde-haired, blue-eyed people, you know? So that's all I could say. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a Michael Lauk that writes our blogs, wrote I hadn't had a chance to look at it, but he wrote on both George Adamski and Van Tassel. And, you know, I mean, these guys were out there, you know, in some of the things they said. But, you know, it was right after the war, World War II, and, you know, things were, you know, people were looking in different directions. You know, the contactee claims are pretty fringy, but interesting and amazing the type of following that these people could muster up. I mean, you said, what, 15,000 people at a time would be out there?
Exactly. And again, like I said, it was after the war. And here's the thing that I always thought, as a historian, you have to take a step back, because this was after the war. It was also, Van Tassel was giving people a chance to come, you might say, come out. From a lot of my history research, many of the people that attended these conventions, they were people who were kind of like left in hiding. They were people who never had an opportunity to even talk about UFOs, to talk about their experiences or X-Files or government conspiracies. And for the first time, people were coming out and gathering and talking about these things in public. And it was an interesting thing, because even in the research files that we had, you know, they were under a lot of scrutiny. And the government, you know, I don't, you know, as part of the whole conspiracy thing, you know, the government had their eyes on this. George has an FBI file that's 4 inches deep. And, you know, this was a very, very interesting time. And it was very scary for a lot of these people, especially out here in the desert. You got to figure, and if you ever see pictures of where this rock is, and how we live and where this is out in the middle of nowhere. So, and you also got to look at the fact that this is also at the same time Roswell was coming out. And so people were just starting to come out of their shells and feeling maybe their freedom, where they can start talking or mentioning, you know, government X-Files, conspiracies, and maybe taking steps against the government. So that's what I kind of look at it as. I kind of look at it, as I tell people nowadays, that it was almost like the Burning Man of its time, and, in a weird way, because as it evolved from the 50s into the 60s, you look at the photos and the pictures, you actually see people, you know, getting more dressed up, and it became more artsy, and it became more like a Trekkie convention or, you know, Comic-Con or something like that. It did evolve. And Life magazine has a very good documentation of it. So in 1957, if you want to look up in Google and Google it, Life magazine has some great photographs of Giant Rock and the Van Tassel era out there.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Bohemian movement in, you know, on the West Coast. And, you know, people were just looking for, like you said, they were looking for something after the war. And this is definitely fascinating. And, you know, some of the claims, you know, George Adamski made are way out there. And, you know, people have called him a con man, you know, I mean, I don't know. I have nothing to say about that. But I just want to let people know that if you're listening live, you can jump in the chat room at podcastufo.com. And I'm also going to allow call-ins. If anyone wants to call in, they can dial 603-967-4030. So getting back to other contactees, have you looked into other ones that were involved out there, or was it just a small handful?
Many of the contactees are gone now. However, I did get an opportunity of Frank Strange's. When I first moved out here, I actually tried to start up some of the Van Tassel, you know, get-togethers, and I would have them at the Integratron, and they were called Retro UFO, And at the time, Frank Stranges was still alive. And I was able to have him come actually, he came to two of these venues that I had, and he did some speaking there. And then there was another man, Robert Short. He was also a participant, and I've talked to him quite a bit about what happened there. And Bill Hamilton, I don't think he wasn't part of the original contactees. But I've also been in contact, and I talk with the Adamski Foundation. So, and, you know, I, as a historian, I try to stay open-minded about a lot of the information, because like you said, there's a lot of information, and you weigh it all about, you know, con men and how people felt towards these people that, you know, came out here. And that's, you know, to be honest, that was one of the biggest aha moments for me, because when I did move out here, I was so excited about the information that I was finding about Giant Rock and the Integratron, and I thought, man, this is the most exciting information. Why isn't everybody excited about this? This is so great. And then, you know, I thought the local people would just, you know, be so happy that I was just finding all this. But as I started doing more and more research and I was able to talk to more of the local people, I found that divide, that the people that knew him and the local people that had experience with what went on out here. And as I did get involved with the Historical Society and I did oral histories with people, I got to hear both sides of it. And so it gives a different perspective to the history of what went on out here. But in that same realm, I also got to hear some fabulous history and collect some amazing pieces of memorabilia about how in the 50s and 60s, how this local area was such a hotbed for UFO sightings. I got to tell you, The local people in this area of the Morongo Basin, UFO sightings were so commonplace that the people here would actually publish in their local newsletters and local newspapers, they would call in their sightings of UFOs, and they were so well documented and so commonplace that it was just like, oh, he saw that up on the hill today, and they were so descriptive about what they saw that was another part of the history here that made me so excited to live here, because it was part of their history, and it's part of Giant Rock and part of the Integratron, and it makes sense to me even more now. Why, like something like Contact in the Desert, why something like that could be held here in this part of the desert, because it is such an attraction for that type of phenomena. So.
Now, there's some questions coming up here and there, and it's kind of hard to work this message board sometime. Did you move there to the Giant Rock area yourself purposely for any of this?
My husband and I, we were coming here so often, and we had a very successful, we still have a successful business going, but we were living on the Southern California coast, and at the time, we had a business going, and we had an office with people in it, and we were coming out here to the desert so often that we invested in a house out here, you know, because we were about ready to take up stock in the local hotels. So at one point, knowing that this house was sitting out here in the desert and we were coming so much, that one day I just had a meltdown. I just said, I cannot sit on these California freeways any longer. I'm getting older. My husband was getting older, and we just decided in 2004 that we were coming out here to the desert. And because of the business we're in, the internet and computers were coming into a phase where we could work on our jobs and do things at a distance. And to answer your question, I don't want to say I specifically moved here for Giant Rock, but in my heart, I did. And okay. I did, and I compare myself to, you ever see Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Richard Dreyfuss when he's sitting there and he's building the devil's tower out of his mashed potatoes?
Yeah.
That's how I feel sometimes.
You're building the rock, aren't you?
And no matter how I try to get that rock out of my system and I go, I'm not doing this anymore, I'm not doing it anymore, something will happen and I find myself being researching something new, or something new pops up, and you know, like this UFO popping in my life in March, and I'm going, why did this happen? It just dragged me back in. So yeah, I'm hooked.
Now, how far away are you from Joshua Tree?
I'm from Joshua Tree. I'm about 5 miles.
5 miles. Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, so you're doing this thing at Contact in the Desert where you're bringing people out to Giant Rock, aren't you?
Yes, I am. And we'll go to the Joshua Tree Retreat Center, and that's right at just down the road from where I actually do live. And then in the evenings after being at the retreat, people can join me, and we'll caravan out to the Giant Rock in the evenings. And sit there at night and be able to star watch, see things in the sky, and sit there until, you know, late into the evening. And then we bring them back.
Uh-huh. Now, a question up on the message board. Have you interviewed the children of the inventor of the how do you ever say that anyway?
Oh, the Integratron.
Integratron. Got it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. Think of Tron, the Disneyland.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Now, George Van Tassel was the inventor, and George Van Tassel died before it ever got turned on. So it never, you know, turned on. And the Integratron is now presently owned by three sisters, and they operate it. And what they do there and what their brand is they don't work it like George Van Tassel intended it to work, because Van Tassel had it. It was called more of an electromagnetic static generator. It had more of a scientific background, where it was intended maybe to rejuvenate more with electricity, and. Actually, if it was ever really going to turn on, there are some people that say that it could have been a time machine, and it has all kinds of science to go behind that also. But today, if you go up onto the Integratron website, you'll see that the new owners and the owners that have it now, they rent it out, and they also do things there called a sound bath, and they use crystal bowls, and they do healing. And do things within the grounds of the Integratron.
Someone wants to know if they'll be younger if they go into that thing on the message board.
Well, it's all a state of mind, you know. To be honest with you, the Integratron's brand and how they like to work over there is they really want people to have their own experience. So if you go to the Integratron, you go with an open mind, and you get to experience how you want to experience the Integratron. Because each person, many people go there to experience it for music. There's been people who will go there and do recordings. It's a fabulous sound chamber. That's what it's really been noted for. And that's why doing crystal bowls in the upper chamber will heighten your cellular structure or do things. People who go there for others to get in touch with their spiritual self, you can do that because of being in touch with the vortexes and where it does sit. Other people will go there just to, you know, just to get in touch with the desert and the surrounding areas. It's an art, you know, it has many outlets. So they encourage people to experience the Integratron in their own, you know, way that they want to experience it.
Now, why can't this thing be turned on?
As they say, who says it's not? So it might not be turned on in the way that George Van Tassel intended it, but, you know, energy is energy. And the way and where it sits, when we take people even out to the desert now, you feel an energy. People feel something. And, you know, whether it's something good or something, you know, not so good, or just something neutral, you will walk away from just feeling a desert energy. You're going to notice something different within yourself.
All right, so let's go all the way back to whenever the exact date is that Van Tassel moves out there, and it's in the middle of nowhere. He finds, you know, the big rock and all that, but how did he survive out there? I mean, there can't be any place to easily to get food or anything like that at that time. You know, maybe now it's a little bit different, but from what I understand, it was like in the middle of nowhere, like you said, and nothing available. How did they survive?
That's a very good question, because he had a wife and three daughters with him. And also what is out there at the giant rock, that the previous person who was before him at the giant rock, there was a man named Frank Kreitzer. And Frank Kreitzer was a miner, and he has a whole other story that we don't have time to go into. But Frank Kreitzer dug under giant rock, and he dug a 400-square-foot area under this 25,000-ton boulder, if you can imagine that.
Sounds like a death wish to me.
Well, if you knew Frank Kreitzer's story, he eventually committed suicide and he blew himself up. So it was a death wish.
Oh,
eventually.
Okay.
He has a very interesting story. And but Frank Kreitzer and George Van Tassel were friends. And after Frank's suicide, that's when George Van Tassel moved his family out there. And another thing that Frank Kreitzer did is he built an airstrip out there, and it was called Giant Rock, Airport. So there was an airport out there. And then also what George Van Tassel also did when he moved out there is he built a restaurant. Can you believe this? In the middle of nowhere, he built a restaurant.
So he could feed himself.
It was very profitable, though, because
really?
one of the people who became very interested in this whole adventure of the Integratron and Giant Rock was Howard Hughes. So Howard Hughes was one of the first contributors into the Integratron. And Howard Hughes was famous for flying his airplane in to the Giant Rock Airport just to get a hamburger and to get a piece of the apple pie that George's wife would serve. So this is a really interesting historic story, isn't it? And when people were coming to these conventions out in the middle of this desert, they would fly their airplanes in, that's how they would get there. They would fly airplanes, they would come by their campers, and they would drive cars. And if you would see this place, it's covered in boulders, and they would have these areas where people would just sit over all these boulders and these big open desert areas, and the road, there was only one dirt road that led into this area, and the road would be lined with airplanes. That's how they got there. But as for them surviving there, they had to drive, and they had to go like 3 miles to have water trucked in, they had to have a container out by the giant rock because there was no water. There was no air conditioning. There's no porta potties. There was nothing out there. And I often, as a historian, I had an issue with that because here you go, you have a husband, you have a wife and three daughters. And I go, gosh, if he did that to me, I would just, man, how terrible, you know? And in George's writings, he would talk about that's why he built the restaurant for his wife. So it gave her something to do and something to, and it was called the Come On In, and that's what they named the restaurant. And so it was for his wife to, you know, cook her meals, and it was a very popular place around here in the desert for the locals to ride around and to stop in. And when you have 15,000 people coming to a, you know, conference or convention in the middle of the desert, I can imagine it's kind of profitable. Although the first restaurant only had six seats, so you know, I don't think it held many people. And eventually they expanded it, but it was a rough life. The daughters, I can't imagine, because the daughters themselves, in order to go to school, they had three daughters, and they would have to go almost 5 miles to the nearest road just to catch a bus, to get on a bus that would take them another 45 minutes to get to the nearest school every day.
Wow.
So that would be their life. And I just thought...
Hang on just a second. We have a call in here. Welcome, caller. Would you like to ask... what's your name, and would you like to ask a question?
My name is Ray Stanford, and I was there. I knew Van Tassel.
Oh, hey, Ray.
Yeah. Am I talking to Martin?
Oh, yeah. How are you? Good to have you on.
Yeah. Well, I'd heard enough. I think I ought to set the record straight about what was really going on now at Van Tassel's place.
Yeah, go right ahead. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay. Let me say that starting back in the 1953 October, on into 54, I corresponded with George Adamski at length as a high school student, and I got to know him and fully believed him until in the late 50s. He took compassion upon my twin brother and I who were out there. And one morning after he, I guess, had loosened up with quite a few eggnogs, as they called them, eggnogs in his Polish accent, he told us that he never had to meet any physical space people, that he had picked this all up. He didn't use the word psychic. He said by a unified state of consciousness, and showed us this book, Pioneers of Space, in which he wrote the same things he claimed had happened to him later inside the spaceships. And he'd written this way back in, I forget whether it was in the 40s or the 30s. And he said, frankly, that he did all this for money and that he wouldn't have had to get into all this saucer crap. And that was his exact words. And that was money. Now, Adamski took us down into what he said was his workshop. And this was a little room adjacent to the highway side going up to Mount Palomar of his place there at Palomar Gardens. And he opened the door, and here in the room, on little tiny strings, were glowing fake little UFOs, which he had used in his faking of his mothership photographs, and the old kind of curved over, falling down from back behind black image of the mothership was there in the background where he had faked these pictures. And I think he had just taken compassion on my brother and me and decided two young people shouldn't waste their lives following his myths that he had done for financial reasons. And I have to tell you, I have to crumble your cookies here, anybody who believes in Van Tassel, but George Van Tassel claimed that he met Sol Gunda on the desert and that he was a Venusian. Well, he describes the craft that he says came down, and it was the fake scout ship that George Adamski photographed. I have on my old computer, my hard drive back there, in fact, I have a photograph of this model that he used with one side of it bent in. It was not real. It was not a Venusian spaceship. And George Van Tassel would just plain believing, knowing that Adamski was popular, he made that story up, claimed he met Sol Gonda, and he claimed that Sol Gonda gave him basically the secret of the integratron and the universe. He said the great mathematical secret was F equals 1 over T. F equals force, T equals time. That is totally nonsensical, useless, and ridiculous. It has nothing to do with physics. It's pure fantasy and imagination. Now, the statement has been made tonight that 15,000 people are out of these conferences. Well, that's pure ballooned baloney. They were not. I was there 3 different years, and I spoke there one time. And there were about a maximum, if we reduce that by a factor of 10, there were a maximum of 1,500 people out there. Now, to call this an airport is utterly ridiculous. There was, he called it Giant Rock Airport, and he called the little cafe, which was a tiny little thing, that come on in, I-N-N. And he had pictured these fake mothership photographs of Adamski's up all over the walls of the little come on in. But by golly, I was at those conferences, and I spoke at one of them, and there absolutely were not that many people. The landing strip was only that. It was just a cleared place in the desert. It wasn't paved. There was no control tower. There were no landing beacons. There was nothing electronic there, no radio to communicate with aircraft or anything. People just came in. I flew in there one time with Robert C. Beck in his private plane, my brother and I, and he could land there. That's all he could say. I listened recently to an old recording for TV that Van Tassel made, and the interviewer asked him, well, how did he make any money out there? And he said, oh, well, this is people paying me to come in and use the airport. That's not true. That's not true at all. I believe that the Integratron would never have functioned in the first place. Yes, it was wood, and he made all kind of claims using this fake formula. And by golly, it's a good thing he died, because he would have been totally embarrassed, because it simply would not function. It was not based on anything, any scientific principle or anything else. It kept on bringing in money and contributions by believers, so it kept Van Tassel going. But I believe the thing was basically partly fantasy of Van Tassel, and partly, I think, a tendency to just plain old... use it to bring in money. I can't prove that, but let me say that no one has ever showed that there's anything in that building that would work. And I just had heard so much hype tonight about this man and his story. And I can tell you, I can swear to it, that it's fiction. He never met... Oh, he also gave the dimensions on this recording, and he had published these. I had all of his publications, the Proceedings of... Universal Wisdom and all this, had everything he ever published. But Van Tassel said that the thing that landed out there, that came down and hovered just above the ground, rather, was he described exactly George Adamski's little fake model spaceship that he had photographed. And he said it was 36 feet in diameter, I believe about 18 feet high. And he said that he was taken up through the middle of it, with Sol Gonda following him. And when he gave those dimensions and he described Sol Gonda, he's describing Sol Gonda as 5 feet 6 inches tall and with this long blonde hair, and exactly as George Adamski described the alleged Venusian that he claimed he met on the desert. And I want to say that I also knew George Hunt Williamson, Rick Williamson, personally. And he told me that they never saw any man out there on the desert talking to George Adamski, contrary to what was claimed in the book Flying Saucers Have Landed. So if anybody wants to believe George Van Tassel and his claim that he met the guy that George Adamski met, they better rewrite their own book, because it never, ever happened. And George Adamski confessed all of this to my brother and me and said it was for money. Any questions?
Okay. Can I make something very clear now? Am I able to talk? Are you over?
Go ahead.
Available?
You've been talking all night. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, okay. I'm a historian. I'm not a ufologist. And the one thing I do want to compliment you on is the fact that you have a lot of facts. And that is wonderful. And I'm going to back up your facts. I'm going to say that you are very correct in what you're saying. because in much of my research, those are the same facts that I've come across. For the purposes of radio and things, I offer information that people have. I answer questions. And to get into all the facts that you've just come into, those are not the questions I've been asked. So the other thing that I would share with you is that Adamski, as a historian, the one thing that did happen, that George Adamski came to the very first UFO conference with George Van Tassel. And George Van Tassel and George Adamski did not get along at all.
Just to let you know, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we only have about a minute. And so, Ray, you're not going to be able to talk about this. Yeah, we have about a minute left right now.
Okay, so, but I will agree. And I do agree, and I encourage people to look at the whole story and to hear both sides of the story. And if you would have heard my talk in the very beginning, you would have heard me say that, you know, I encourage and I want people to know both sides. And I also want to reference that the people that lived here gave two sides to the story. There are people
I appreciate that. By the way, I did listen to you from the start of your interview here. I've heard all of it, and I appreciate what you said.
Yeah. There are people that absolutely supported George Van Tassel in what he was doing, and then there are people that did not. And I don't come off on either side of the fence. I, as a historian, I relate facts, and I will always state facts and stories, and I will let the public and I will let people make up their own minds and their choices of what they want to believe with regards to how UFOs. I do have many, many documentations of the Morongo Basin in this particular area and how UFO sightings were documented and how the people of this particular area observed and noted and were excited about their history of this area and how they viewed it. So, you know, that's I'm very grateful, and I welcome your I'm thank you for even bringing that up.
Okay, I'm sorry we're going to have to cut this short, and thank you Ray for calling us, and thank you very much. Also, Barbara. So I want to thank a couple of people for helping out with the show. First, our guests this evening. And also Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And we're going to be here next week with Leslie Kane and Jose Lay from Chile. And that's our show for next week on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next week. Keep your eyes to the sky. We'll be right back.